Welcome to the program for Wednesday, August 31st, 2011 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The 3 o'clock hour on Wednesday is always devoted to Pentagon Solutions, our series of deep dive conversations in which we call on experts on defense issues, both inside and outside DOD. These experts share ideas that leaders in the Pentagon and the contracting community can use to solve the big challenges the defense community faces. Some background on the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan, because that is the focus of our conversation today. Their website is wartimecontracting.gov, and that website says on July 18th, 2007, Senators Jim Webb and Claire McCaskill introduced a bill to establish an independent bipartisan commission on wartime contracting to study U.S. wartime contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill was inspired by the work of the Truman Committee, initially led by Senator Harry Truman in the World War II era. Congressman John Tierney also introduced language similar to the Webb-McCaskill Amendment in the House of Representatives in September 2007 as a standalone bill. The National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal 2008 established the commission and assigned its duties. They were required to study, assess, and make recommendations concerning wartime contracting for the reconstruction, logistical support, and performance of security functions in Iraq and Afghanistan. The commission's major objectives included a thorough assessment of the systemic problems identified with interagency wartime contracting, the identification of instances of waste, fraud, and abuse, and ensuring accountability for those responsible. There are 8 members of the Commission on Wartime Contracting. The co-chairs are Michael Thibault and Christopher Shays. The other commissioners are Clark Kent Irvin, Grant Green, Robert Henke, Catherine Shinazi, Charles Tiefer, and Dov Zakheim. Their biographies all linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. I'm very pleased to have on Pentagon Solutions today 2 of the commissioners on the Commission on Wartime Contracting, Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim, are my guests in studio with me today. Ms. Shinazi, it's great to see you. Thank you for coming today. It's our first time to have you here, and I thank you for being on.
Thank you, Francis, for having us.
And Dr. Zakheim, Dov, it's great to see you again. Thank you for coming in to talk to us today.
Good to be back.
Catherine Shinazi concluded over 30 years service at the Government Accountability Office in 2009. She was Managing Director for Acquisition and Sourcing Management for the last 6 years of her time there, and her portfolio included operations in the Departments of Defense, State, and Homeland Security and cross-government acquisitions. She's now a senior advisor to the Conference Board, a nonprofit research organization in New York City. Dov Zakheim's a former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Planning and Resources and former Comptroller and Chief Financial Officer at DOD. His industry experience includes Booz Allen Hamilton and System Planning Corporation, and his new book is called A Vulcan's Tale, How the Bush Administration Mismanaged the Reconstruction of Afghanistan. The Commission on Wartime Contracting, as I mentioned, was charged with sending a final report to Congress. The release of that report was this morning, and so I'm very pleased to have both of you here to talk about this. Catherine, I'll start with you. You said at the event this morning that there were very few surprises as your commission did its work, and you are obviously, based on your work at GAO, very familiar with all of these things. But there was one thing that did surprise you. Talk about that, please.
That's correct. I think when we talk about dollars in this town, particularly when you're dealing with the Pentagon, it really doesn't matter if you're saying millions or billions. You just sort of say the number and move on. Mm-hmm. And I think what continues to surprise me and disturb me, I will add, is that when we came up with our estimates of waste and fraud at $30 to $60 billion, that's an almost unbelievable amount of money. Mm-hmm. And it still does not resonate. People are still arguing about the need to change and whether or not it's important for us to try and bring those numbers down. I think one of the things we did in this report to try and put a human face on it was get down to a daily number. But even on a daily basis, we have about $12 million every day that we believe these recommendations can make a real dent in. Mm-hmm. And the fact that those numbers just don't force action, I think, continues to surprise me.
Why do you think that's the case when everything we talk about, every time I talk about any federal agency, especially DOD, and especially the State Department, as you looked at the state, the DOD to state transition in Iraq in particular, but also in Afghanistan, every time I talk about a federal agency, the subject seems to be budgets are tightening, money's getting harder to come by. So in that context, why do you think it is so difficult for those numbers to resonate?
I think there's a particular resistance when we talk about national security, because the way the debate has been framed, there is no value that you can put on a soldier's life, which is absolutely true, but there is no there's nothing that we shouldn't be spending, particularly for our military operations. And so looking at what is really required for these missions to be successful and for us to undertake these missions never has a dollar value to it. One of the recommendations in this report that we're trying to bring some more sort of focus on the cost of the decisions that we make to go overseas is the one where we have recommended that a new position be created to straddle, a dual-hatted position to straddle both the National Security Council and the Office of Management and Budget. Right now, the National Security Council decisions are made totally independent, not just of agreement by the Office of Management and Budget, but in many cases without the knowledge that OMB can bring to bear about the various costs of alternative strategies.
I certainly don't mean to denigrate the importance of national security decisions. I like feeling safe in my country as much as the next guy, but that seems to me to be a very basic budgeting tenet, that you evaluate how much this is going to cost and is it worth it?
And I think this idea that there needs to be a recognition that there is a business side of war is something that I hope does not get lost. I'm hopeful that this argument does not turn around strictly the dollars and cents, because it is not just about dollars and cents, and certainly we all realize that, and this report goes to a lot of issues that are not specifically dollars and cents, but there is a business side of war, and we have to recognize what that is so we can better manage that to allow us to undertake all of those activities overseas that we need to undertake.
Dov Zakheim, you said this morning at the release of this report, your comments focused in the beginning at least on some of the unfinished projects that are either not going to be completed by us and will become the responsibility of whichever country those projects are happening in, or that they're still not done and we will continue to pay for those as time goes on. You sent me to my encyclopedia and I didn't get a chance to go there and actually do it. You said we will find ourselves in a Hobson's choice.
Yes.
Define that for me, because that's not a term that I knew before you said it this morning.
Well, Hobson's choice is colloquially defined as a rock and a hard place.
Okay, that one I know.
And the problem is basically this. If we've started projects, which we have, and some of them were undertaken by the Agency for International Development, some were actually forced on the Agency for International Development, believe it or not, and it turns out that the Afghan government or the Iraqi government, depending on the project, is unable to maintain the facility that's been built. You now have a choice. You can either say, well, we'll just forget about it, and the money we've spent is money wasted. Or you could say, well, we can't do that. We'll have to keep maintaining the facility ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, either way, the American taxpayer is losing out. Because for God's sake, why do we undertake a project without knowing how it's going to be sustained and managed? And we, in our report, document cases of this. We are tremendously concerned about it. And the number, the dollar figure that attaches to these projects goes well beyond the 30 to 60 billion. To put some clarity on this, who is going to finance the ongoing training of the Afghan National Security Forces? At some point, is it going to continue to be the United States, or will the Afghan government afford it? Right now, it looks like the Afghan government cannot afford it for the foreseeable future, in which case, we're the stuckies. Is that really how we're supposed to do things?
This goes to a bigger problem, not just in DOD, but all across government, and that is the either inability or unwillingness to consider life cycle costs. What is this, not just what this is going to cost us to do it today, for example, build a building, but maintain it for the 30 to 50 years that it will exist until it's no longer used for that purpose. Why is that so tough in particular, do you think, for DOD to think and plan for?
Well, the department, and it's not just DOD, you're right, it's government-wide. Policymakers rarely think about the consequences of their policies in terms of implementation. They may think in terms of the political consequences. But when it comes to the dollars and cents side, it's just not something that even crosses their minds very often. And as a result, what you get are decisions based on the here and now, as opposed to decisions based on third and fourth order consequences 10 or 15 years from now. The Department of Defense, particularly the military side, because a military person thinks about what his or her job is today and in 3 years' time or even in 2 years' time will be somewhere else, it's a little bit understandable why they do what they do. But, of course, there are a lot of defense civilians as well, which really raises another question, if I may. Why haven't our civilians, not just in DOD, but throughout the government, played a much larger role in Iraq and Afghanistan than they have? Because to the extent they have not, we have defaulted, to use a term in our report, to contractors. There are many cases where we would think it should not be contractors doing the job, but rather civilians. That has not been the case.
I want to explore that a little bit more later on in the program, and I'd like to hear, Catherine, your thoughts about that, too, when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are two of the commissioners of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan, Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim, and our conversation continues on Pentagon Solutions in just a moment.
Beltway Q&A. The guest is Dan Doherty, Vice President of EMC Federal. Today's question, how can IT managers support the mission while facing budget cuts and the increasing cost of managing information?
Federal customers have to do more with less. EMC Unified Storage saves you money in two ways. It's simple to use and reduces your storage cost through greater efficiency.
So EMC Storage saves money because it is simple, efficient, and affordable?
That's right. Federal customers can do more with less.
Now available on GSA schedule through government acquisitions.
Hola, Santi. So, where to for dinner?
Hola, April. You look great.
Hey, new radio?
Yeah, went to Best Buy. Those Geek Squad installers were cool.
What is that?
JVC HD radio receiver. As beautiful as you. HD2, HD3 channels, and iTunes tagging. Plus, no subscription fees, so I save money for taking you to nice places.
Forget dinner. Let's get my car to Best Buy.
Let's do both. Best Buy stores are everywhere.
HD radio. More radio, more value.
This week's Kaiser Permanente Experts in Health topic is cholesterol management, featuring Dr. Lon Nguyen, Chief of Adult Primary Care in Northern Virginia for the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group.
Cholesterol is essential for the human body to function, but high cholesterol can be very harmful. High cholesterol promotes plaques to build up in the arteries, blocking blood flow, which can contribute to a heart attack or a stroke. Here are tips to manage your cholesterol. Know your numbers. First, measure your cholesterol levels every 5 years if you are over age of 20. Remember, your LDL should be low and HDL should be high for optimal levels. Get at least 30 minutes of physical activity a day to lower your risk of heart disease. Maintain a healthy weight. If you are overweight, lose 5 to 10 pounds can help lower your risks. Disease prevention is the best way to help you stay well and thrive.
To learn more about Kaiser Permanente's Experts in Health, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
You may have a big heart, but do you have a strong heart? Balance nutrition and exercise with regular checkups. Help build a strong heart. A strong, healthy heart lets you share your big heart with those you love.
Hi, I'm Congresswoman Donna Edwards. Make healthy choices to maintain a strong heart. Eat lots of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and stay active by biking or walking 5 days a week.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station. Tom Temin here with a preview of tomorrow's federal drive. Sure, it can be tough to maintain civility when your budget's being cut and everybody's screaming nasty things about federal bureaucrats. We'll have tips for how to breathe deep. Plus, the Wartime Contracting Commission has delivered its final report. Now what? The commission's budget expert joins us with predictions. Those stories and more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The focus of Pentagon Solutions today is on the final report to Congress of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we have the final report linked up for you to review at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And two of the eight commissioners on that commission are my guests in studio to talk about it, Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim. There are 15 recommendations in this report, Catherine. Are there a couple of them that you think are the most important ones, the easiest to execute, most potential savings or prevention of waste, fraud, and abuse, or a couple of them that you think that are worthy of particular highlight?
I think I would point to the recommendations that we made to create new positions, particularly the one on the joint staff. I'm not always a fan of moving boxes around in a bureaucracy to get change. And I realize as you focus on one thing, you may not be focusing on other important things as well. But particularly for the military services, and I'll tell you why. There are two reasons for that. One is we have seen pockets in the joint staff, and those represent the military commanders in the field, who really recognize the change needs to occur. Commanders who don't have control over contractors in their battle space, who don't understand what it means to monitor a contract, who haven't been given the resources to do the contractor monitoring that's required. And they need help. And I think our recommendation, although the joint staff is not, has not fully embraced it, this is a good time to position the military for the future. The military is going to go to war with contractors. It's going to conduct other operations besides war with contractors. They are currently in a process of re-wickering themselves what is important, and this is probably the best time to do that. So I would put that out as one.
Okay.
And the second one, if I can just have a second one,
of course,
is the fact that we've brought Congress into this mix. Congress is, many of our recommendations, many of these changes can be made without legislation, but the Congress needs to be there to force those that are not made voluntarily, to institutionalize those that depend on this leader or that secretary who will come and go as the years go by, and to provide funding and the allocation of resources that's necessary to get these implemented. So Congress's part needs to be and to work across the committees, which is a problem that we've identified. Congress needs to be part of the solution.
I want to come back to the new positions shortly because, Dov, you indicated some agreement with that at the event this morning. But I want to ask you in particular about the congressional element. My takeaway from this was that, as I tried to at least read between the lines a little bit, the message to Congress seemed to be, this can't be a helicopter mission on your part where you come in, do a few things to make it look like you're being involved and then go away and leave this all to the way that it was. This is, it sounds to me like you're asking for an ongoing engagement in all of these issues with the, some of the, especially some of the most important committees that are involved with these things.
That's
in
correct.
Congress. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. As was noted this morning, we go out of business in 4 weeks. And I think the fact that we've been around has helped to keep attention on the issue. And we are concerned that as Afghanistan and Iraq go off the front pages of the paper and other issues come to bear, that change will not, there will not be sustained change in the agencies. So I think your point is accurate.
Dov, what are two or three of these recommendations that are the most important to you?
Well, let me start with the ones that are the lowest hanging fruit, which can be acted on very quickly. One is the creation of an office of Inspector General for Contingency Operations. We currently have an Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. We have an Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. Their mandates are actually limited, and at some point they're going to go out of business. We've had contingency after contingency for the last several decades. It's very difficult to identify a year where we weren't involved in some contingency. An Inspector General who will be there with a small but expandable staff will be there to ensure that the kinds of concerns that we raise in this report are being dealt with. People act differently when they know there's an IG looking over their shoulder. So that's one, and it's an easy one, and it's one that can be implemented virtually immediately.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is the whole question of suspension and debarment of contractors. There are, as I understand it, several pieces of legislation moving through the Hill right now to make it easier to suspend or debar contractors. We believe that those pieces of legislation, which focus on the Defense Department, should be expanded government-wide. It should include state. It should include AID. Again, just as an IG sends a message to the executive branch, suspension and debarment sends a message to contractors. It's not meant to be a punishment, but it is meant to be a message.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's action that Congress could take quickly. And if I may identify a third one, and Catherine alluded to this earlier, I believe it's critical that we create a dual-hatted position, that is to say, somebody with two jobs, one foot in the Office of Management and Budget and one foot in the National Security Council. Now, in the past, there have been times where the OMB has overreached and has tried to micromanage departments. That's not good. But it's equally not good for OMB not to be in the conversation at all. And unless you have budgetary clout, all your policy pronouncements tend not to go anywhere. Think of all the czars we've appointed over the last few years. A drug czar, this czar, that czar. How much clout do they have? If they can't force budgetary action, people will nod and say yay verily and move on.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to do is ensure that that doesn't happen in this case.
I would like to hear your thoughts on the structures of some of these new positions and where they would, where those people would sit and who they would report to and who would report to them when we come back. Because as I read through this, it seemed to me that those were the easiest things to ramp up and potentially the easiest to demonstrate a return on investment. So we'll talk about that some more when we come back on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today in our conversation on the final report of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan, our commissioners Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim, and we'll continue in just a moment.
Here in America, as a country, we've seen our share of rough patches. And as a company, we at AT&T have gone through our share together. And history tells us what to do in times like these. Don't back down and don't hold back. You push forward and invest in the future. That's why we're working to bring ownership of an American telecom company home from Germany. Together, the planned merger of AT&T and T-Mobile will unleash the deployment of the next generation of wireless internet to nearly everyone in America, creating tens of thousands of new American jobs. And that's just the beginning. Building growth and the new jobs our nation needs right now. Why? Well, we know it's good business because America has always been and always will be a smart investment. AT&T. Rethink possible.
To defend our nation effectively, missile defense must be affordable, available, and reliable. Lockheed Martin's team for ground-based mid-course defense is the right team to meet this challenge. Our proven performance-based logistics capabilities have been refined on more than 50 programs and honored by 9 Secretary of Defense awards. Increasing confidence and readiness while reducing sustainment cost is all a question of how, and it is the how that Lockheed Martin delivers. For ground-based mid-course defense, the Lockheed Martin team has the know-how for success, the people, the processes, the performance. Together, we have built strong government-industry partnerships, led the industry in performance-based logistics, and built systems that have achieved more than 50 intercepts in test and combat, assuring affordability, availability, and reliability for ground-based mid-course defense is all a question of how, and it is the how that Lockheed Martin delivers.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does 3 decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
Beating the Heat. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. When we're outside in the heat, we're at risk of heat illness. But if you're a male or someone 15 through 19 years old, you could be at greater risk. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, researcher Ellen Yard.
Heat illness begins with heavy sweating, pale skin, feeling very weak or having a headache. And as it progresses, it can lead to dizziness, confusion, or unconsciousness. And that's a medical emergency. Initially, if it's caught early, you can simply remove the person from heat.
Yard says all heat-related illnesses are preventable.
Different things you can do are taking a lot of water breaks, trying to restrict your activity to early or late in the day, and having an exercise partner.
The study was in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan has released their final report to Congress. It's just out this morning, and it is linked up on federalnewsradio.com right now. 2 of the 8 members of the Commission are my guests on Pentagon Solutions today. Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim are in studio with me. And we talked about the recommendations in the last segment, and you both agreed that some of the most important recommendations revolve around some new positions that would be appropriate for dealing with contingencies in the future. I guess I'm a cynic from following government agencies and their operations for a period of time, but it seems like just about every commission recommends some kind of new position for some kind of job. So talk about, Dov, we'll start with you. Talk about these positions, especially the inspector general positions, where they would live, who has the authority that these people would have, or if the authority even exists now, who they'd report to, what the vision is that the commission has for these jobs.
Basically, there are 3 sets of jobs that I think we're talking about. One is the inspector general. One is the person who would be both at OMB and the National Security Council. And then one would be the group of assistant secretaries in the major national security agencies, State, Defense, and AID. The first one, the inspector general, clearly would get his or her authority from the Congress, his or her budget from the Congress, report to the Congress. That already creates a very, very different kind of environment. We see this, Stuart Bowen, who's been an excellent inspector general for the reconstruction of Iraq, as well as the Afghanistan Inspector General, because they are independent, independently funded, independently reporting, they have quite a degree of clout. The problem, of course, is those offices will wind up and their mandates are limited. We would want to give the new Inspector General for Contingency Operations a very broad mandate to poke around wherever he or she thought was necessary. And being, in effect, a creature of the Congress would make them much less prone to the kinds of pressures that somebody inside the bureaucracy would have to face.
Mm-hmm.
The person who would be both on the OMB staff and the National Security Council staff would derive authority from two places. To be an OMB a deputy director, which is the number two level at the Office of Management and Budget, you've got to be confirmed by the Senate. That gives you a certain degree of clout, and of course then you're managing dollars, which gives you an even greater degree of clout. On the NSC staff, you're appointed by the president. Congress doesn't get into it. In fact, the executive branch has strongly resisted for years Congress getting into those appointments. Having both hats gives an individual tremendous power because they report to the president effectively from two directions. The third group is also a very important group. Assistant secretaries are Senate confirmed. That gives them a certain degree of power that those who are not Senate confirmed just simply do not have. Assistant secretaries can and often do report to the agency head. Some assistant secretaries in the past, I think of somebody like Richard Perle, have been phenomenally powerful in their areas. This would create a degree of leadership within state, defense, and the appropriate equivalent at AID that simply does not exist today. And then they would have offices under them. They would be the advocates for managing these issues. And they would, by working together and being coordinated by this other individual at the National Security Council level, would clearly foster a degree of whole-of-government activity that just doesn't exist today.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, you certainly know your way around an audit. Where would that inspector general live, and what would make he or she have the kind of power that the commission is writing about and that Dov is talking about?
Right, and you notice I'm not the one who's talking about the inspector general, right? I think that some of those details are yet to be worked out, but I think the idea of having a group of people that are ready to go, that are trained in certain procedures and audit techniques, forensic auditing, to be a little technical here, mm-hmm. those things which are really needed in theater in the early days, is probably as important, as some of the other, things around that position.
So the point is you're not casting about when you decide all of a sudden we need somebody and do we go out and find Stuart Bowen and get him to come in and do this job that we've just created from scratch. Is that right?
Because even though the work has been very well done and, very worthwhile, it took a long time to get it done. And as we all know, it's those early days and those early stages when there is the most scope for problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just add to that, if I may. What Catherine just touched on is extremely important. There's always a tendency to say, well, we'll wait till the next contingency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. Look how long it took to get an inspector general for Afghanistan. We were, 7 years into the war when that happened? 7 years is an awful long time for war. We need to have these people available at the get-go.
But doesn't that reflect an ongoing worldview, and it's not an ideological worldview, it seems to be a nonpartisan worldview, that at some point we'll get to a point where there are no more contingencies. It seemed like we came out of the Cold War with that concept. Well, it's the world is going to be different, and we're not going to need all of these people and machines to do the things that the people and machines needed to be ready to do for the past 50 years. And it seems now, if we've learned anything, and I'm even seeing it from some of the things that military leaders are saying at DOD, there's finally a recognition that what you're saying, Dov, is sinking into people, but that wasn't the case up until very recently,
That's
it seems
true.
Like. Is that fair?
And look, people look at the newspaper and they see the word Libya. They see Yemen. They see Somalia, although we've been there and failed at that once before. The point is we're recognizing that contingencies, which is often a euphemism for war,
mm-hmm.
Are going to be around, have been around. And that to wish them away is not going to make any difference. And the other thing is that we can never predict where the next contingency will be.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis, you're not the first person to put that out there. And because of that, we did some research on this, and you will see in the report that the U.S. has engaged in 56 ventures abroad for other than normal peacetime purposes since 1962. I mean, 56, right? And they're quite, when you lay it out there, you say, oh yes, I remember that. I remember that. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
I love the term. What is it again?
Ventures abroad.
For other than peaceful purposes.
Other than normal peacetime purposes.
Yeah, I love that phrase.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a gold star for whoever wrote that part of the report. My guests on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM are Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim, commissioners on the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're going to talk a little bit when we come back about how this consensus was reached and the structure whereby this report came out. It's In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Here's your chance to get out for some fun. Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News.
Well, SouthwestVacations.com has a package to get you to Orlando for Halloween. Deals include admission to the Universal attractions there in Orlando. And you can book this on Southwest Airlines until October the 27th at SouthwestVacations.com.
Okay, what else do you have?
There are a lot of big festivals that come up in the fall, but a really popular one is the Mountain Heritage Craft Fair near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, September the 23rd to the 25th, and it is huge, a whole mountainside full of arts and crafts. You get the discount coupon to attend on page 11 of the August Recreation News. On the same page, you can check out the packages at the Quality Hotel in Harper's Ferry. That might come in handy if someone in your party isn't really into the crafts. They can take advantage of the golf or the Charlestown races and slots, and all of that's available through the package at the Quality Hotel.
Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News. I'm Ruben Gomez.
Your new Cocker Spaniel is waiting to meet you, and you don't have to travel very far. This weekend and almost every weekend, Oldies But Goodies Cocker Spaniel Rescue holds at least one adoption show in the greater D.C. area. Find out where we'll be this weekend by checking out CockerSpanielRescue.com. Stop by to meet the many homeless Cockers of all ages who are looking for their new home. These dogs have already been spayed or neutered and have all their shots. For more information on adoption, fostering, or volunteering, visit CockerSpanielRescue.com.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Jeff Zients is the government's chief performance officer.
This is a continuation of the effort that we've had ongoing since the beginning of the administration, and today's an important day to be pulling all the performance information together in one site and opening it up to the public. We'll continue to add new areas. I mentioned data centers and our consolidation efforts there. The public also ramps up accountability, and we'll also have feedback, which will be invaluable for agency performance.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federal. Drive.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 technology corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Commission on Wartime Contracting's final report to Congress is out today, and as my guest Catherine Shinazi said earlier, they'll be out of business in about a month or so. In addition to Ms. Shinazi, Dov Zakheim is my guest, another member of the Commission, and talking about the final report. Dov Zakheim, you were appointed to the Commission by
President Bush.
And Ms. Shinazi, you were appointed by
Senator Reid.
There are four Democratic members and four Republican members of the commission, and you can learn who's who at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We have the bios of all eight members linked up. Talk about, though, in an environment in Washington where I think if you went to any of the 310 or so million people outside the Beltway and said, we have found eight people who are experts in the federal government and operations of government, and half are from one party and half are from the other party, and they're going to produce a product over a three-year period in which all eight members totally agree on everything that's released to the public, people would say, that will never happen. It's not possible. Based on what they know from what they see, when it comes to operations in Congress. You've achieved this. Other groups have achieved similar consensus. How do you do that? How do you take people who are ideologically not the same and find areas of agreement where you can put a product out like this?
That's a great question. I think individually we were each committed and therefore collectively committed to getting a report out that we could stand behind. Mm-hmm. So there was that, before we even started down the paths of what was it going to say, I think we really felt that there would be strength in putting out a report without a dissenting opinion. So we started out with that mindset. Mm-hmm. Then we focused on the scope of what we were doing. What are the problems? And I think if you look at the different chapters, you'll see that we found the problems to be much broader than how do you write a contract. But yet we were not, we decided not to take on should we go to war, for mm-hmm. example. So we spent a lot of time agreeing on the problems. And then we worked through. It was hard work. It was frustrating work. But in the end, I think we ended up with something that we're all the 80% solution. Mm-hmm. So that's better than nothing.
Why is that so hard to reach oftentimes in this town, Duff? That 80% solution.
Well, first of all, here I would disagree with Catherine. I think it was better than an 80%
solution. Okay, there you go.
We focused on implementation. In other words, if you were going to be in a contingency, here were some of the major issues. Here were some of the things you had to worry about. Here's what you needed to do about them. So many people in this town focus on policy. They don't focus on the second and third order consequences of those policies. Mm-hmm. And yet, that's really what this report is about. You make a policy decision to go to war somewhere. It doesn't matter whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya. It doesn't really matter. How you then deal with the issues that arose that we addressed in this report, where you have as many contractors as you have troops, where they're essentially a shadow force, where they lose people and nobody notices, as Commissioner Shea said this morning at the press conference. You know, thousands of contractors have died. There are no ceremonies at Dover Air Force Base. And so we're not dealing here with the great issues of the day in the sense of do we go to war or not go to war or whatever. We're dealing with implementation. We're dealing with good governance. We're dealing with saving the taxpayer every penny and putting it to better use. What is the point, for example, and we have this in our report, of paying off insurgents for protection? That money is our taxpayer money, and it's going to the people who are trying to kill our boys and girls? There's something wrong with that picture. Mm-hmm. We tried to deal with that.
We focused a lot in the media, and you focused throughout your work on the issues of waste, fraud, and abuse, and some of the more egregious examples came out through the hearings that we ran highlights of on this station and other outlets reported on. It would be easy for someone to take away the concept that much more is wrong than is right. Is that a fair characterization, or does a lot go right when it comes to contracting in these two war zones? Catherine, you want to take that?
It depends on how you define right. And so we have heard a lot, and you heard in the press conference this morning, the troops are very grateful for the support that they get for contractors. So there are, that goes right. But from my perspective, the way I would answer that is, if we can't bring to bear the resources we need to make decisions about when do you use contractors and the resources to manage them once we decide to hire them, we shouldn't have them. Mm-hmm. And if that means we can't do as much, then so be it. Mm-hmm. But it is that part of it is so wrong that if we don't come up with the wherewithal to do a better job of managing the contractors that we're using and deciding when to use them in the first place, then I would not say more goes right than goes wrong.
Dov, you said something at the event this morning that I thought was very interesting. You said, ask the question rhetorically, who's to blame? And then you said, everyone's to blame. You were the chief financial officer at the Pentagon when some of this was underway. So does everyone include you?
Oh, of course. I would include myself simply because I tried and failed to clean up some of these contract messes. My deputy director of DCAA, of the audit agency, was none other than Mike Tebow, who was my co-chairman on this commission. We identified some contracts that had, to use the jargon, not been properly definitized. In other words, they weren't spelled out properly. We tried to do something about it. We raised Cain. We failed. I will accept that as a failure. I also happened to be the civilian coordinator for Afghanistan for the department, and I saw firsthand that we were simply not spending enough money at that point to help rebuild Afghanistan, not to throw tens of billions, but an extra billion or two. We took our eye off the ball. And because we did that, when we later flooded the country with money, it couldn't absorb it. Now, it wasn't just the Bush administration. During the 1990s, we cut back on so many acquisition personnel, on so many people who would be responsible for oversight and management, that we were left shorthanded. So, yes, there's enough blame to go around, frankly, for the past 20 years.
Dov Zakheim and Catherine Shinazi are my guests on Pentagon Solutions today, talking about the final report of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll be back to wrap up our conversation in just a moment.
Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The Transportation Department wants to create a digital transportation exchange, or DTE, to more easily connect with its customers across the country. Nitin Pradhan is Transportation's Chief Information Officer. He says DTE will help create an online marketplace for transportation technologies. The digital transportation exchange will help private companies connect with DOT agencies and with other companies to work on common problems or challenges. Transportation will hold a forum on DTE September 23rd.
Desktops, tablets, smartphones, thin clients. If you're in federal IT, these are your challenges. Visit cdwg.com/configuration to learn how our experts can help you meet them all with configured, imaged, asset-tagged client computing solutions. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how HP's ProBook and EliteBook lines of notebooks can help keep your agency mobile and productive.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Robin East is the Treasury Department's CIO. She says program management will receive a boost through the use of the IT Infrastructure Library Standard.
You always have to look at the needs of a particular organization, perhaps where you have the greatest opportunity to improve service management in the short term, and start there. We have chosen, at least preliminarily, to do a better job of describing our services and our service levels.
Whether your organization calls it cloud, utility computing, managed services, or capacity services, at the core is the rapid provisioning of information technology infrastructure. At Vion Corporation, they pioneered capacity services 10 years ago. Vion was awarded the first and currently holds the largest federal government capacity services contract. They provide government IT owners an agile financial vehicle for meeting mission-critical IT needs. Vion and Hitachi Data Systems have been delivering IT solutions to the government for over 31 years. Visit Vion.com to learn more.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 200 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, yes, John, but what does your company do? Well, my company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations to help improve the way they collect data. You may call it comprehensive data collection, data analysis, or even outcomes measurements. If your agency has any problems with collecting, analyzing, or displaying data, then please visit our website at armaturecorp.com. We can help.
My family struggled, and it was assumed that while I would go to college, I would have to pay for it myself.
Charlie wasn't sure how to get the money she needed for college. Then she found out about federal student aid and the FAFSA.
I don't think I quite realized what a huge deal actually graduating was. Federal student aid definitely made that happen.
Need help planning and paying for college? Find out more at college.gov.
My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Just a few minutes left with Two of the eight commissioners of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan, the commission's final report to Congress released just this morning, and Catherine Shinazi and Dov Zakheim have been my guests for the hour to talk about the report. Catherine, you now are a senior advisor to the conference board. Tell me in just a short period of time what the conference board is and what you're going to do, since, as you said, you'll be out of business, at least commission-wise, in 30 days.
Right. The conference board is a nonprofit economic research firm that's in New York. It was started before the Commerce Department was collecting statistics on the economy because the companies in this country needed to understand what was going on. So it has a long and distinguished history. It puts out the leading economic indicators that are widely followed. I've actually been working on something totally different, which is the social and cultural impact of 21st century information and communication technology. So we're going to be publishing a book in conjunction with the Telefonica Foundation. And after that, I don't know. You know, this is a great town, and I don't think I'll ever get tired of trying to help out here.
That's an issue that agencies struggle with. So when that book comes out, I would love to have you come back and talk about
it, and
see if we can help some agencies with some solutions there. The only thing I know about your future, Dov, is that you are saddled with the terrible situation of having to come back here on Tuesday and talk about your new book, which is called...
A Vulcan's Tale, How the Bush Administration Mismanaged the Reconstruction of Afghanistan, which I guess relates to some of what we talked about.
And I can imagine from the title of the book that there are some of your former colleagues who probably are not too happy with the contents of that book or the thesis of the book.
Well, not too many of them would be unhappy. I hope I treated them fairly. My concern then, and I guess we'll talk about it next week, is precisely what I mentioned earlier. We underfunded Afghanistan when we should have funded it, and we're now in the middle of a war that I consider unnecessary precisely because we underfunded it.
We will talk about that topic more on Tuesday at 3 o'clock on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My thanks to both of you for being here today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Francis.